Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights with me, your host, Katie Kiefer. We are broadcasting live from the Heritage Radio Network studios in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And today we're going to be talking with Patty Lavera, who is the Assistant Director of Food and Water Watch. She coordinates the food team. Patty has a bachelor's degree in environmental science from Lehigh University and a master's degree in environmental policy from the University of Michigan. Before joining Food and Water Watch, Patty was the Deputy Director of the Energy and Environment Program at Public Citizen and a researcher at the Center for Health, Environment, and Justice. And doesn't that sound just like a dating game intro? Are you old enough to remember the dating game?
Yes.
I'm going to have to work on that. So, Patty, my interest was caught by an issue that actually came up in all of the meat trade papers that I read on a regular basis. And then subsequently, we at Heritage got a press release from Food and Water Watch about this very issue. And I'm going to give a little background. We're going to be talking about CAFOs and pollution. This little background bit here explains kind of where this came from. In 1972, the clear water pollution threat posed by CAFOs, and that's confined area feeding operations, otherwise known as feedlots, staggering waste stream led Congress to mandate that the EPA must regulate CAFOs pursuant to the Clean Water Act. And despite this 40-year-old mandate, the EPA continues to lack basic data about factory farms, including accurate and consistent information on their size, location, and waste management practices. Okay, that's strumifying enough. But tell us about the motion that you, along with HSUS and a number of other environmental and community groups, have filed recently to intervene in the case that was filed by certain parts of the meat industry against the EPA to shut down gathering this very basic information about CAFOs.
Sure.
It's a little bit complicated.
We've had a couple things happen in the last couple of weeks. So this has been going on since the 70s, like you just said.
Right.
So the EPA has never really figured out a way or had the political will to figure out a way to regulate the water pollution that comes off these very large livestock operations. So we're not talking about, you know, a small family farm with 50 cows. We're talking about lots of animals in one place.
Thousands
of heads. Factory farms that have
right.
lots of animals in one place, and therefore they have lots of manure in one place.
Yes.
And there is a water quality problem that comes from that. So all of these, there's been lots of legal efforts and different attempts to try to get these things permitted under the Clean Water Act, and we're not there yet. The system is not working. We don't have a functional system for permitting these things. But last year, the EPA was supposed to do a rule. They were supposed to write a rule, and it's called the 308 rule because that's the section of the law. And it was just supposed to let them go out and gather information about how many facilities are there, how many animals are there, where are they, basic information, which is the first step before they're ever going to track them or regulate them or figure out what's going on. And under a lot of pressure from the industry, the EPA abandoned the rule. They just stopped doing it.
Well, they claim that the reason that we don't need the rule is that this information is already on record in states and through other mechanisms.
Right. That was that was their excuse. A bunch of groups were unhappy about that. And one step that people took was they used the Freedom of Information Act, and they said, tell us what you have. If your records are so great and you have such a handle on this industry, show us what you have. Mm-hmm. And when we got those records, EPA asked for them back, which is kind of extraordinary. That doesn't happen. The government answers a FOIA request, gives the public records, and then asks for them back because they were under, again, terrible pressure from the industry.
Uh-huh.
Some folks gave the records back. EPA supposedly blackmailed a bunch of information that was, you know, too sensitive to give out.
Mm-hmm.
Gave it back, and then asked for it back again. And so it just shows the terrible pressure that they were under and that they weren't willing to stand up to this industry. So to make matters worse, the American Farm Bureau and the National Pork Producers Council, which represents the largest players in the pork industry,
right.
They then sued the EPA and said, you can never give information out about this industry again. We're going to try to stop you with this lawsuit from ever answering a FOIA about where factory farms are again. And so just this week, several groups, Food and Water Watch, Environmental Integrity Project, and Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement filed a lawsuit to say, to try to intervene in that case, so mm-hmm. that it's not just EPA negotiating with Farm Bureau, that somebody else is at the table. So we have to find out if we're allowed to do that.
Wow. So what, you know, let's go back for a second and tell me exactly what kind of data did the EPA release or would release related to industrialized animal agriculture that has them so scared? Is it the numbers? Is it the, you know, the literal numbers of animals on farm? Is it the names and addresses of those operators? What, and when you say it's not mom and pop ranchers or smaller farms, which are often the feeders to feedlots, as we all know, it's like you have a grower who's going to grow them out from, say, you know, cow calf or you know, just get them up to a certain weight, and then they go to a feedlot, right? So it's mm-hmm. not the smaller guys that you're talking about. It's where these animals are aggregated in large quantities prior to slaughter for their last sort of, like, whatever it is, 2 or 3 months of feeding up. I don't know how it works so much in the pork industry, but that's how it works with cattle. So what exactly is it that's got them so wound up about this that you're going to find out that they don't want you to know?
Well, there's what they're saying, which is along those lines that, you know, we can't disclose this information because this might be people's homes, because, mm-hmm. you know, they, some people do live, especially with chicken operations.
Right.
It tends to be, you know, somebody's family farm, and then they get into the chicken business and they grow chickens on contract to a
right.
Purdue or to Tyson. You know, same thing with some pork operations, but not all.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're saying there's a lot of rhetoric from those guys about this is a privacy issue and it's too much, you know, it's too much intrusion by the government. But really what it boils down to is that they don't want to be regulated. And if they can stop, you know, even this basic information collection,
right.
then we're never going to get to the point of having EPA require permits and, you know, having a rational system for dealing with these facilities under the Clean Water Act.
Well,
and so we actually kept the records that we got from the FOIA. And we looked through them, and it's a mess. It actually shows that EPA doesn't have a handle at all on what
uh-huh.
is going on with these facilities. And they said, oh, well, we don't need to collect our own information. We'll get it from the states. We'll get it from other places. And we, you know, we had to write a 6-page document explaining that we couldn't figure out what they know because every state is doing it differently.
Mm-hmm.
Different states report into different databases at EPA. So no one has a handle on this industry. So for them to claim they don't need to do this information collection is bogus.
Absolutely. I think it's bogus. And if they have nothing to worry about, then why is this such an issue? This is like this. It goes back over and over again to the issue of transparency within the livestock agriculture sector, you know, where it's like they've dragged their feet on every single thing, whether it's antibiotics or beta agonists or waste disposal. It, you know, whatever it is, they're going to draw a curtain over it as best they can, which is so unfortunate for them because talk about sending the wrong message to consumers. But I want to go back to the fact that I thought that all large feeding operations had to get some sort of permitting in terms of especially wastewater and manure management. So you're saying to me that in states such as Iowa, and I thought it was really interesting that it was the Iowa Citizens were part of this, of your motion, that they literally don't have to develop any kind of treatment plant that is mandated by the state or permitted by the state or examined by state engineers. Nothing like that happens. It's just like if you feel like going into business, you just do it. Is that what
depends
we're talking
where
about?
You are. And it's, I mean, the mess is too kind of a word to describe the status
right.
of the system. So in places like Iowa, they have a huge presence of factory farms. They have egg producers. They have
mm-hmm.
a ton of hog producers.
Yes.
There's even some feedlots. And their state does make them get some permits. But it's not, you know, but the group that we're involved with, Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement, they have their own list of accidents and spills and, you know, waste
mm-hmm.
Overflows from lagoons. And so they've kind of got a permitting system there, but they don't have enough enforcement, right? So they are fighting every year in the legislature to get the bodies in the state agencies to go out and look at these things and see if they're running safely. In other states, they don't get permits. And where we are with the federal, you know, the federal rules, which are supposed to be the foundation for this whole thing, is we have, you know, 25 years worth of lawsuits trying to figure out how to force EPA to do this in a uniform way. And what it boils down to at this point is the last round of revisions to those federal rules said that the facilities can say, well, we don't have any intention to discharge into a body of water. So if you don't have an intention to discharge, you don't have to get a permit. So
oh, wow.
It doesn't take
so
a lot
you
of
can just
to say, okay. I'm going to say I don't have an intention to discharge.
Right, because you're going to say, well, I'm building this pit. I'm building a lagoon. And if, even though it's only maybe 300 yards away from a local stream, I have no intention
right.
of discharging into the stream. Of course, it may happen, but it won't be my intention. And thus,
right.
they are not liable, and thus, they don't have to get a permit. This is astonishing. I have to say that in all the 5 years I've been doing this, this is a part of the puzzle I didn't really understand. I had no idea that it was so loosey-goosey when it came to enforcing any kind of environmental protection for local waterways. Oh, my gosh. I can see why Food and Water Watch is so involved in this.
and that's what's so outrageous, that they won't even get this basic data about where they are.
Right. Right. Or how many there are.
We're having a rational, permitting scheme. We're talking about getting the information about how many facilities there are.
Right. And these facilities, and again, to go back, I just want to hammer home this thing about the privacy thing, because later in the second segment of the program, which we're going to come up to in just a few minutes, I'm going to quote you some of the rebuttals from Drover's Cattle Network, Meeting Place, and so on, that says, well, this is really all about the privacy of these farmers. It has nothing to do with what we're planning on doing. And indeed, to be fair, Cargill, for example, where I went on a tour a few years ago, they had an incredibly impressive wastewater management program in place. And I think with some of the larger players, that was for a cattle feedlot, or for a slaughterhouse, actually, for a slaughtering plant. And of course, needless to say, they generate immense quantities of wastewater in the cleaning and butchering of cattle. Their wastewater management was extraordinarily successful and extraordinarily expensive, and they seem very committed to making that work for that particular processing plant. So what we're talking about, I guess what I wanted to clarify in my own mind, is that we're talking about feedlots, concentrated feeding operations. We're not talking about slaughterhouses, which may have to go through a completely different permitting process. Am I right about that?
Exactly, and they do. So the law is much better interpreted that's one building with a pipe going out with wastewater, and so it's very clear that they have to have clean water
right.
permits and treatment and all of those things. There's always been this problem getting that same coverage for agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why we're, decades into this law, the Clean Water Act, which came around in the 70s, and they've
right.
never quite been able or willing, which is probably the bigger problem,
right.
to apply it in this way when it's a waste lagoon or you're disposing of the waste supposedly as fertilizer, but it's so much in one place. This is way past the point of using it as fertilizer, and it's really waste disposal on land.
Yes, it is. I mean, I think a case in point, a lot of the listeners may be aware of the recent sort of defeat in court in Maryland about, I think it was the dairy farms, right? And they brought us, you guys were involved in an action there where dairy farms were polluting the Chesapeake, and in the end...
chicken farms, actually.
Oh, sorry,
yeah.
It was chicken farms, okay. But ultimately, it was never really... somehow, the chicken people won, and I still haven't figured out how that was.
That became a case because we don't have good enough rules. And so it was a case about one particular facility to see if sampling that a local environmental group had done could link what was happening, on that particular facility to damage that was done to a particular creek.
Uh-huh.
And so sometimes in court, it works out, and sometimes it doesn't. And
right.
so one of the interesting things about that case, though, was that the way that the chicken industry is set up, so in this case it was a Purdue contract grower.
Right.
So they're not really farmers. They're growing birds on contract to Purdue, who owns them the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
So the farmer takes out a debt, takes out a mortgage to build the barns. They own any chickens that die. They own the waste, which when you have that much in one spot is no
right.
longer a fertilizer. It's really a liability you have to
yeah.
dispose of. Purdue owns the birds, and they bring the feed, and they make all the decisions. And so one of the issues involved in that case was trying to get at that relationship between who makes the decisions. Is it Purdue, or is it that farmer that they're happy to use as the front for the whole thing?
Right, fascinating.
And so I think there'll be more conversation about that in places like Maryland, where there's a huge poultry industry.
Yes, absolutely. And there's lots of dairy around there as well. Well, Dedrick, let's take a really short break for a sponsored drop. And Patty, stay on the line. We'll be right back with Patty Lavera, who is the Deputy Director of Food and Water Watch. We're talking about naughty EPA rules and lack of oversight in confined area feeding operations and agriculture. Stay tuned.
Thank you. This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world, highly processed fruit and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
Welcome back to What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights with me, your host, Katie Kiefer. And on the line with me today is Patty Lavera from the Food and Water Watch. She's the deputy director there, and she's talking to us about some challenges that have been raised to the EPA, which has basically caved in on trying to record how many confined area feeding operations exist in our country and what kinds of permitting processes they go through in order to manage their waste disposal. So, Patty, I'm going to jump now to the response from the industry, because as you know, I'm an avid reader of all of the trades and actually something of a darling, as a matter of fact, in the meat industry, believe it or not. Even though I rake these guys over the coals all the time, it's like, I don't know why they keep coming back for more. They just invited me to speak at another conference. I'm like, okay. I'm so glad you enjoy being insulted. But anyway, according to the National Pork Producers Council, at issue, as we discussed before, is the disclosure of contact information, farm location, permitting status, to type and number of animals and number of acres. Now, I don't understand how this kind of personal information about the operators really is sort of the issue at all. I mean, like getting their names and addresses, how is that going to help you in helping to control pollution and helping to enforce some kind of regulations? Because to be honest with you, it sounds to me like it's just yet again a situation where it's wildly underfunded by the federal government, that any kind of monitoring or regulation enforcement is basically non-existent simply because the resources haven't been allocated to it. Do you agree with that, or do you think it goes?
I think their biggest missing resource is backbone on this issue. Yeah. There's always going to be resource issues for enforcement, but is an agency that is afraid to stand up to the meat industry. And it just happens time and time again over the last really 25 years that they've had an opportunity to create a system and then they back down. So they really just walked away from this opportunity to make this rule that would have just figured out a system to figure out where these things are, how many are there, how many acres of land are we talking about that regularly have, you know, manure applied to them as a waste disposal. Right. I mean, that's, before you know how to regulate it, you have to know what you're dealing with, right? And so if they don't have this information, then it gives them an excuse not to regulate. So, yes, there will be enforcement issues and how do you figure it out, and yes, we live in a time of tight budgets, but that's not their problem on this one.
Well, I think just determining when it stops being fertilizer and becomes waste disposal, has that even been addressed, like in terms of like literally calculating the number of cubic feet per, you know, whatever, of waste that goes on?
I mean,
when does it become an issue?
It depends who's doing the calculating, of course. You know, one of the things that does exist on the books, if one of these facilities does choose to say we're going to get a permit, or maybe their state makes them, it does, there is some variation state to state, and they have to have a plan. It's called a nutrient management plan, which is how are you going to dispose of all of this animal waste? And, you know, we've taken a look at them in some places, and this is way beyond anything that you would call agronomic, right, using it as fertilizer. It becomes about disposal. So I'm here in Washington, D.C., so the Chesapeake Bay is very close by. It's, you know, it's a big regional, you know, characteristic for us. Everything's about the bay, and it's also, you know, a notable ecosystem, and it's in trouble, and it's been in trouble for a long time.
Yeah.
We have so many chickens on one piece of land, the Eastern Shore, and so now the plan is to truck that chicken waste out and just get it anywhere that's not the Chesapeake Bay watershed. So that could be a plan, but it seems like there's a better way, you know, to deal with that with a better system. So, you know, this is all, it's just kind of a stark realization of how far behind we are in grappling with this industry, which has dramatically changed how we raise animals.
Yeah, it sure has. I'm going to read you a very fun quote from the National Pork Producers Council spokesman, Dave Warner. I'm sure you saw this too. This was in Meeting Place. He says, "This is a frivolous lawsuit without merit. The EPA data collection rule that is the subject of the lawsuit was part of a backroom," I love this language, "a backroom sweetheart deal between EPA and activist environmental groups and the agency's attempted end run around the limits on its authority under the Clean Water Act. EPA rightly withdrew this proposed rule. How do you respond to that kind of language? I mean, sweetheart backroom deal? Are we kidding?
The sweetheart deal is pretty hilarious because that's a term... That's the exact phrase that our side of the fence used for many years to describe a deal that was made between the meat industry and the Bush administration to not regulate air emissions, which is a whole other can of worms we're not talking about today. What happens
to
the
air later.
Quality? And they came up with a study under the Bush administration that meant that nobody was basically ever going to have to report air emissions until they did this incredibly long study. And everybody started to call it a sweetheart deal. So they're throwing that phrase back in our face.
Very
particular
nice.
Quote.
Yeah, I loved it. I thought that was great. And what are the limits of the EPA with regards to the Clean Water Act? I mean, why are there what kind of limits is he talking about? How does the EPA have limits on whether or not they regulate the Clean Water Act?
So this, I mean, this has been I think it started in the 80s. So this has been 25 or 30 years of lawsuits about how to make the Clean Water Act apply to agriculture. You know, it's very clear how it applies to a sewage treatment plant or a factory that makes something and they have one pipe that comes out, and that's very clear. And there's been just constant legal wrangling over how it applies to anything else. And so... this is really, you know, it's kind of an ideological war about how the Clean Water Act applies to any kind of land use or agriculture in particular. And that's one of the favorite points of the industry side of things, is that this is not the EPA's business. And we think that it is. You know, this is an impact. We know that these facilities discharge, and it's way, way, way overdue that EPA figure out how to do that.
Yeah, it's amazing to me that the EPA is so completely lacking in backbone. I mean, we've seen it over and over again. I mean, just the emissions thing that you mentioned about the sweetheart deal with the Bush administration over air emissions. You know, it is disappointing when the Environmental Protection Agency turns out to be protecting somebody else's environment rather than yours and mine, if you know what I mean. It's like they're protecting the banking environment, they're protecting the Wall Street environment, but they are protecting our environment. The other quote that really struck me during when I was doing my research for this show was that even the state regulatory agencies questioned the need for federal law, as they already collect the information in question, which you mentioned is completely discombobulated. There's no rigor to it. There's no consistency to how the data is proposed. And so the EPA withdrew the proposed rule. And in the withdrawal document, the EPA, where appropriate, will collect CAFO information using existing sources of information, including state, national pollution discharge elimination system programs, other regulations, and other programs at federal, state, and local level. So I guess what you're saying is that this National Pollution Discharge Elimination System program is not really a national program. It's really a state-to-state program, and it's not coordinated. Is that
right?
Is that what we're saying here?
You know, a bunch the information that we got from that FOIA request, and it was kind of in a shambles, and it was not easy to go through, which speaks to the state of their information at EPA. But one thing that we did see is that different states are complying with different eras of the law. So some were complying with the 2008 version of how EPA said they were going to deal with CAFOs. Some were doing 2002. Some, it wasn't clear what they were doing. So we definitely have a patchwork, and that's not about flexibility. That's just about, you know, in places where the industry is very powerful, the states are less likely to do a good job. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, when EPA, to go back to this information collection piece, when EPA bailed out and said, we're not going to finish this thing we said we're going to do, they said explicitly, the states have this and we can get it from them. Well, when we looked through these documents, there's a quote from the state of South Dakota saying, yeah, we may not give it to you, EPA. Like, we may not turn this over.
Wow.
So, that is just broken. I mean, this is not acceptable. In other sectors of the economy with other polluting industries, there's some basic information that's available, and that's how it's supposed to work. We have an entitlement to this kind of information and a transparent system, and it's just not okay for certain states to opt out and say, we don't have to give it to you. You know, the public doesn't have a right to know this. We have a right to know this for chemical plants. We have something called the toxic release inventory. Like, for lots of other sectors, we can figure out, you know, what the contribution to the environment is, and it's not appropriate that this industry just gets carved out.
Well, one of the points that you make in your press release is that it's not just a question of simply manure and excessive manure. It's all of the inputs that go into that, including the chemical waste that is discharged by the animal through, of the various growth promotants that it's fed, through the various antibiotics that it's fed. And all of these things kind of come together. I mean, the industry has such a big job ahead of it in terms of revamping how they do business overall. And I have to say, I read the most fantastic editorial the other day in Drovers by Dan Flynn, who's their editor, about how, you know, the industry really must just suck it up and deal with this antibiotic thing. Like, they can't keep blaming it on consumers and doctors, you know what I mean? Which was really encouraging to me. And I feel like there's been enough outcry about that piece of it that there's starting to be movement in the industry. And I think if there's more people signing on to what you're doing in terms of how waterways are being polluted, that there's going to be movement towards that too. But one of the reasons that, one of the things that I'm always remarking on about the cattle or about the livestock industry in general is the level of paranoia that they express towards groups like yours and towards Humane Society of the United States and so on. I mean, it's quite remarkable, and I'm sure you're well aware of it. And it's so their fear of the loss of privacy and so forth is correlates with their fear of literally of being vandalized, of having livestock damaged, of having infrastructural damages. And those episodes do occur. They may not be all that frequent, but they do occur, and they are legitimately, to be feared, I think, if I were an operator on any level. So how do groups like yours kind of deal with the sort of overzealous activists who do in fact attack people's property and animals? What do you have to say? I mean, how can your sort of groups kind of regulate that sort of outside of the box activity?
Well, we obviously don't condone that, you know, and don't really have relationships with folks who do that.
Right.
But I think, you know, and it's never appropriate for that to be what people choose to do to protest something. But we do think that this is getting a little overblown. It's not as common as it seems to be portrayed in some of this, you know, trade industry. And I don't think that shutting down information is an appropriate response to that. So, you know, we're aware of that. We're aware that there is that concern in that community, and that was supposedly driving, you know, what we saw all through state legislatures in the last year about these ag gag bills.
Absolutely.
That you can't take
yep.
a picture. You know, and this is just, it's overreaction. If it's justified, I'm not entirely convinced it's justified for the number of things that have actually happened, but if it is justified, it's over. It's just an overreaction, and it's swinging too far. It's not an acceptable way to run, you know, an industry in a democratic society that's based on some openness, and that's it just isn't okay. It's not acceptable.
No, it's not. Well, I think the industry has suffered a tremendous backlash after sponsoring all those ag gag bills, and I mean, even within the trade groups themselves, they're starting to question the wisdom of putting somebody in jail for taking a picture, you know, or sending a drone over. I mean, it's, you know, it's been a little crazy, and I think, you know, I'm constantly amazed at the failure to negotiate with the public, and that's going to take me to my last question with you right now, which is just sort of a maybe even almost ingenuous. But do you feel like there's ever an opportunity to engage directly with these trade groups or with industry heads to talk about these issues? I mean, it seems to me like it's always so polarized between the activists on the one side and the industry on the other side, and they never get to talk to each other. They never seem to want to. And I feel like that there's a lot of, I think that, you know, there's a lot of hostility. There's so much hostility that it has really sort of broken down the whole business of trying to come to some kind of compromise or move the train forward a little bit. And how do you respond to that? I mean, do you guys ever get a chance to, you know, sit down or go to the agricultural conferences and listen to what their concerns are and then express yours? Because I don't see that happening.
No, it isn't. And I think we're in a particularly polarized time. I think that's true. But what's fascinating for us is the difference between the heads of these trade associations and the biggest members, who are always the meat companies. And then when you talk to individual members, you know, individual ranchers or farmers, or even contract poultry growers, who we talk to quite a few of them, and we have a lot in common. The breakdown is the trade associations that claim to represent them.
Right.
And that goes as far as American Farm Bureau, who doesn't really speak for a bunch of farmers, but they're happy to speak for kind of corporate agribusiness when it comes, you know, when we're making decisions on policy. So we talk to an enormous number, and we go to lots of conferences of, you know, farm groups and rancher groups, rural community groups who don't like what these trade associations are saying, and they're trying to call them out as well. So, you know, different groups have different approaches to the, to, you know, dialogues with industry. We don't do a lot of them because they haven't served us very well. So,
very interesting.
If it's, you know, if it seems genuine, we would maybe have the conversation, but most of the time it doesn't. We're happy to talk to and often talk to actual farmers and actual folks on the ground doing it, and we have a ton in common and do a lot of coalition work with them on farm policy, things like country of origin labeling or contracts that these meat companies write with these farmers.
Yeah.
We agree with the farmers on what the contract should say. They could be a hell of a lot fairer. The block comes from the American Meat Institute and the Farm Bureau and these big
and the NCBA
companies.
And NPPC, all of these big trade organizations. I know they're, it's a real, it's like they're almost an industry of their own separate from the actual industry that they claim to represent. I'm always struck by that. Anyway, Patty, I've got to say goodbye to you, but I want you to let listeners know where they can find more information about this on your website and what other kinds of links you might recommend for people to read about this and anything else you want to talk about.
Sure.
In the next 30
we have
seconds.
Everything, you know, we have press releases about these lawsuits and, you know, new developments will be on the press section of our website, which is foodandwaterwatch.org. And then we also have an additional website called factoryfarmmap.org, where we just took USDA's data, because there's no EPA data to get, but we took USDA's data and made a map just broadly about what counties across the country have a huge number of animals being raised this way. And it is kind of like, to put it in that visual is really kind of shocking. And people are using that a lot to kind of get an idea of how we've changed where and how we raise animals.
Fascinating. I really appreciate you talking to me today. I hope you'll come back again soon. I'd love to talk about country of origin labeling with you. There's lots of cool stuff going on. Not cool, but sort of scary stuff going on with that.
Lots of stuff, yeah.
But lots of stuff. Anyway, thanks so much again to you, Patty Lavera, Deputy Director of Food and Water Watch. And next week, my friends, we will be talking with Jane Black, who is just wrote a story for the Food and Environmental Reporting Network in partnership with another publication, which eludes me right now, about SNAP benefits and what the cuts to SNAP may mean to American families in the future should they all come to fruition. And thanks again to my sponsor, Kane Winery, and we'll see you next week for another episode of What Doesn't Kill You. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.